Rebels Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. March is National Women's Month, and on this edition of People's Tribune Radio, our guests are Karen Johnson of the National Organization of Women.
I spent 20 years in the military, and but back in my first several years in the military, I realized very graphically when I was stationed in Thailand as one of 14 females on a base of 3,000 men, mm-hmm. That sexism was going to be, or was as much of a problem in my life and would be, as racism is.
And performance artist, poet, and social worker, Brenda Matthews.
Even though people were suffering and going through things, when they could see on stage the similar situations and saw that there was hope, then they saw hope in their own plight too. So that's why I continue to do the writing in order to reach people in their lives. I saw the two working hand in hand, so that's what I wanted to do, is use the drama and use the poetry, drama, and then skills in working in social service to bring healing into people's lives.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Karen Johnson is the Vice President for Membership of the National Organization of Women. She was interviewed during a conference call by Trini Rodriguez.
Why did you become part of this movement for women's equality?
I think it started out with my military experience. I spent 20 years in the military, and but back in my first several years in the military, I realized very graphically, when I was stationed in Thailand as one of 14 females on a base of 3,000 men, mm-hmm. That sexism was going to be, or was as much of a problem in my life and would be, as racism is. And I don't think I ever came face to face with the fact that because I was female, I was thought of as a second-class person, mm-hmm. as much as I did when I was in Thailand and saw how American GIs were basically demeaning women. That's when I became consciously a feminist, mm-hmm. someone who realized that I needed to fight for equality among the sexes as well as among the races. My whole goal then became looking at a system, looking at working for a system in society where you wouldn't have a dominant subordinate culture, where you wouldn't have one gender being dominant over the other gender.
Part of what characterizes this movement today is also, aside from the gender issues, there's also the questions that are becoming very prominent, that is poverty and violence, as you're addressing.
Yes, and actually, I wish I could say that poverty and violence is not associated with gender, but
right.
What we do know in this world is that women are the poorest. You know, women do two-thirds of the work and get 10% of the wealth of the whole globe. So we have an unequal distribution of wealth based upon gender. Mm. And also, the amount of male violence against women is epidemic. And we see women now being used as tools of war. When you look at Kosovo and Croatia and ethnic cleansing, the rape camps that were held happening there.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at here in this country, the fact that there isn't a woman in this country who's going to feel comfortable walking down a major city street by herself,
mm-hmm.
Because we're concerned about some male attacking us. And just sexual harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment in the schools. You have over 80% of the high school students talking, girl students talking about being sexually harassed by fellow students in the previous year. That's a major problem. I think that women are sick and tired of being poor and of being victimized by men. What I see globally happening is women are saying, you know, in my country, I am a wife, and I have no property rights whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So if my husband dies, I am destitute. In my country, if my husband beats me, that's okay. Even unto death, that's okay. And so women are uniting around the globe to say, we are demanding of our governments that you do something to change the culture, to give opportunity to women and girls so that they can share as equally in the wealth as well as as in the poverty, but
right.
also to share equally in opportunity, and also that you stop using women and girls as punching bags and as objects of violence.
How would you explain the rise in violence? Because you would think that with the types of laws that are in place that are supposed to protect women and bring about this equality, that hasn't quite done it. What would you say? How would you explain this rise in violence against women and also just the violence that is perpetrated on the poor overall?
Well, I think it has to do with the whole dominant subordinate basis for our society. If you had been by gender part of the haves, and all of a sudden resources are getting tight and you feel like you're competing now with women for jobs that you weren't competing with before,
mm-hmm.
I see that happen in the military. I think that's why we have some sexual harassment in the military, is that women are seen as being less than men and not deserving of equality in terms of opportunities and jobs and pay.
Mm-hmm.
So we see it as competition, and therefore one way to defeat your competition is by making them feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be by resorting to violence or threats of violence. And any system where you have unequal power, too, threats of violence have to be used in order to maintain your power. And so I think as men feel more and more challenged in positions of power because of women's push for equality, they're going to be resort to more and more violence, and you're going to see more aggressive kinds of things happening, like you see in terms of the Taliban, where women were really very much part of the Afghanistan society,
mm-hmm.
and now they can't even work or go to school because they're too much of a threat to the male structure.
Well, with the elimination of so many jobs, how do you see this improving?
I see it only improving as we become more enlightened as a society, that
mm-hmm.
we can work differently, that we can look at different paradigm for how we operate,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have to have a dominant subordinate culture, that we can have a partnership, that we can share the wealth. I think we have a real hard time with sharing resources,
mm-hmm.
and we have greedy corporations and greedy people, and the ones who are benefiting most from the greed are obviously men at this time. And I think if we looked at a different way of living in this world,
mm-hmm.
where we share resources, where we have not the CEO of a company making enough money in 1 year that would take you 30 years as an average employee
right.
to make that same salary,
mm-hmm.
But where you have a more equal distribution of wealth, there isn't any reason why you should have so many who are so wealthy and so many who are so poor.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a widening gap between the top 20% of people in this globe who are rich and the bottom 20% who are poor. They're getting poorer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we have to just look at this as being the right thing to do, to share wealth, to share resources. In this country, we're very bad at spending resources.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we're only 5% of the globe's population, we consume 24% of the globe's resources.
Right.
We have to stop that.
Now, you mentioned also, you're alluding to policies that also contribute to this, not just the natural trend towards technology and elimination of jobs by that means, but also the policies such as the elimination of welfare, which of course is contributing to the same problem, no?
Well, yes. I mean, welfare, our organization, National Organization for Women, really worked hard to defeat the welfare reform bill because we realized that it was not a bill that was going to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're talking about 93% of all people receiving welfare being women and children, and coming with a welfare reform bill that only tells you have to start working in a certain amount of time, but not that you're going to get work job training or you're going
mm-hmm.
to get child care or health care
mm-hmm.
provided for your family, then that's really not welfare reform at all. It's just kicking people out into the workforce without having any assurances that they will have the kids taken care of for adequately. and that they'll have health care for their family when needed. My sister has a 3-year-old and she pays $190 a month, a week, for child care. Now, how can you pay $190 a week for child care if you're making minimum wage an hour? So you need to have job training so you can get the better pay. And I think we need to take child care as a community responsibility. The children in our communities grow up to be adults who can contribute to or take away from the communities. Right now we're building more and more prisons, but we have inadequate child care facilities nationwide. And that has got to change, because we know that nationwide 70% of the child care facilities do not provide adequate care for our children. So why would we want to put our kids there where they get inadequate care and ultimately wind up growing up to possibly be folks who prey upon society as opposed to contribute to society?
I wanted to move on to your latest efforts, mm-hmm. and that is the World March of Women 2000.
Yes.
And wanted you to explain to us what your efforts and the focus of that is.
The World March of Women 2000 is a global effort. Right now we have 3,500 groups from 143 countries who have signed on to the World March of Women 2000, which is a march to end poverty and violence against women. This effort is going to be kicked off on March 8th. I am part of the International Liaison Committee. We are from 43 countries on the Liaison Committee to plan this global event, but we're asking countries to do national action to tailor the demands to end poverty and violence in their country based upon what's happening in their countries, and to do national marches in those their countries, as well as we're asking countries to participate in an international action at the UN on October 17th. The National Organization for Women is a group that has taken on a large part of the responsibility for organizing the U.S. action. We have a national coordinating body made up of many organizations from the poverty and violence and feminist communities that will be helping put on this national action and bringing people to Washington, D.C. on October 15th to make our U.S. demands for the elimination of poverty and violence against women. Many of the international community are coming to Washington, D.C. as well to join us in our national march, and then go on to New York City on Tuesday, the 17th of October, for the UN rally, where we will be meeting with Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, to present our demands. We are starting a signature campaign as of March 8th, too, collecting signatures on petitions and postcards to deliver to the Secretary General on October 17th from all over the world.
How does it look for the rest of the countries?
It looks really good. I was at the International Liaison Committee meeting in November in Montreal. The idea was generated by some women in Montreal after they did a poverty march back in 1995. But I can tell you that there are women who are planning activities in Bangladesh, in Nicaragua, in East and West Africa, as well as in Europe, Central America, South America, all over the globe. And they are really very excited. Some women are going to be actually collecting signatures on cloth, collecting this cloth and giving it to the Secretary General. But women are very excited about the action. Many have already produced materials promoting the march, World March, and are really hopeful that a global effort by women in support of men around the world will make a difference in changing the hearts and minds and actions of their governments. If you want to participate in the march, I would direct you to the website www.worldmarch.org or www.now.org, N-O-W.org, for more information on what's happening in this country. You can certainly call our offices at the National Organization for Women at area code 202-331-0066 and ask for the World March, and we have a lot of information there as well. We'll be glad to mail out information to you. We're having our march 3 weeks before the elections, and we want to make the voices of women heard loudly and clearly here in D.C., saying that we count. We are definitely folks who are going to be out there voting, in November, and we want you to hear us when we say these are important things to women and to our country.
Karen Johnson is the Vice President for Membership of the National Organization of Women. She was interviewed during a conference call by Trini Rodriguez. This is People's Tribune Radio. The following segment contains frank language and may not be suitable for all listeners. Brenda Matthews is a poet, performance artist, and a social worker. She spoke with Sandy Reed in Chicago, Illinois.
I've always had a passion to work with people. It all started when I was working at Tabitha House for homeless women and children. And when I left Tabitha House, I came to Taproots, where I've been on and off over the last 10, 15 years. And so I know that I wanted to work with people, especially youth and women. And so I wanted to see them get the services that they needed in order to move on to the next level in their life.
Ms. Matthews discusses combining social work and her performance art and poetry.
Even though people were suffering and going through things, when they could see on stage the similar situations and saw that there was hope, then they saw hope in their own plight too. So that's why I continued to do the writing in order to reach people in their lives. I saw the two working hand in hand, so that's what I wanted to do, is use the drama and use the poetry, drama, and then skills in working in social service to bring healing into people's lives.
And you work now with the schools, don't you, with your art?
Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm in Leif Erickson through Taproots, which is where I work, and through a grant that we get through the health department. We're in the schools doing life skills and early postponement of sexual activity. And so I've been in the schools doing the same thing. Again, it's poetry, drama, social service. You're trying to bring healing to people's lives, utilizing life skills as a way, as a teaching tool, and the drama and the poetry has a certain kind of effect or a certain kind of way that opens up focused discussion and allows these children to open up and say what's really going on.
In much of your poetry, you talk about hunger, poverty, especially among the children. You also talk about how a hungry child is a hungry child, that it doesn't matter what color they are, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
One of my mentors, Nelson Peary, I always heard him say, if you got a black child that's hungry and you got a white child that's hungry, the only thing you have is two hungry children, that color bears no issue on hunger, that hunger in this country has gripped America, period. I mean, there are millions of people who are hungry, despite whatever race they are. It's just that we are living in a land of wealth, and the fact that whether black or white, just the fact that you hear that a child is hungry is scary, since we live in America, which is a land of plenty, and it's really heartbreaking. My vision of a new America is seeing where people have a livable wage, where they have decent, affordable housing, where families are together, where they have health care, where they have needs that are to be met in every area of their life, you know. And until this happens, the struggle must continue. That's my vision, to see families, the poorest of poor, be able to get the things that they need. And the necessities right now is a livable wage, decent, affordable housing, and health care, you know. And when those things happen, we'll have a new America.
I know that you're very active within the religious community, and I wondered if you could comment on how you see the struggle against poverty unfolding there?
Some churches have taken an active role in the struggle of poverty, and some have not. The church has been lacking in joining the struggle in the fight against poverty. And what's strange is that so many people who live in poverty are members of the different churches in the community. But again, pastors do what they join in struggles that they think are important, rather than thinking about what is important as it reflects around the needs of the people. And so I'm very disappointed in what the religious community has contributed as it relates to the struggle around poverty. Now, it's bigger than passing out a few bags of food. You know, some of them have done their deeds by giving out food, but it's just bigger than food. It really is, and they need to be a part of this struggle and understand what it's all about.
And now, the performance poetry of Brenda Matthews.
The title of this poem is "He's Still My Son." From the moment he'd taken his first breath, I loved him unconditionally. With 10 fingers and 10 toes, a face that would warm the heart of a lion. You were mine, and mine alone. You were my awaited gift from God, my prince whom I vowed to protect from all the evil of this world. You were my diamond in the rough, a gem more precious than life itself. Oh, I would lay down my life and die for you, because God had opened up the heavens and blessed me with an angel. As I hold you close to my breast, I feel your heart as it beats close to mine. Your heart beats as that of a warrior, ready to conquer all that was positive and destroying anything that was negative. Wow! While watching you grow up, I imagined what life would be like for us. Sending you off to school, deciding what to fix for lunch, or discovering your many, many talents. It was us, baby, you and me against the world. The years rapidly passed. I now look into the eyes of a young man. Every time his eyes look at me, they ask me, "Hey, Mama, what happened? What happened?" And no matter what happens, this child, now a grown man, still remains my gift. For you see, the world had looked at the color of his skin and damned him before he even tried. The hood took him from me. The homeboys raised him for me. He was a king, and the people were his subjects, subjecting them to his hate, his jealousy, his confusion, leaving no room for errors, because whatever the boy wanted, he took. This boy was a master at playing the game. He robbed, he stole, he'd kill a nigger without even thinking. He put a gun to your head and he'd watch you die. He'd even sing a song. Die, nigger, die. Die, nigger, die. Die, nigger, die, 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 nigger, die, nigger, die. This boy was a heartless, cruel, low down nigger. Somebody you love to pistol whip publicly and let him know, "I ain't taking this no more." This was the brother you personally wanted to pull the trigger and watch him die. Watch him take his last breath and scream, "Die nigger, die nigger, die nigger, die nigger, die nigger, die nigger." And when he closed his eyes, you felt free, you felt safe, you felt vindicated, 'cause he got what he deserved, right? But it's a known fact that even the bad people of this world belong to somebody, somebody's cousin, somebody's brother, somebody's uncle, somebody's father, yes, somebody's son. And as I reach out and embrace my child, the murderer, the gangster, the nigger, the nigger, the nigger, the nigger you love to hate, he still remains. He my gift. He my child. He still my son. When I walk the street, I see people laughing. I see them shaking their head, talking about, that's that nigga's mama, ain't it? Apple don't fall too far from the tree, now does it? Better lock up. Hell, she raised him. Yes, 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 I raised him. But you taught him how to steal, not me. You put a joint in his mouth and a 40-ounce in his hand, told him it was all good. It's not my fault. I did everything humanly possible that any mother could do. I prayed. I preached. I even beat that boy's behind every time I thought he needed it. But my child succumbed, fell for the okie doke in the streets, listening to the niggas, his homeboys, his partners. But I won't give up on it. I'm not gonna turn my back. 'Cause he mine. He my gift. He my child. He still my son. There is an African proverb used loosely today. It takes an entire village to raise a child. But you know what? Somebody down in the village felt that they could do better than I. But he's still, he my one. And he my only son.
That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Thanks to the overwhelming response to PTR in our first year, the program is now available twice monthly and on the internet at www.ptradio.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide is used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name's Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.